This is another episode of Sorry for Rambling, and I am joined today by Howie Hawkins, the Green Party nominee for President of the United States. Howie, thanks for being here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So, Howie, let's jump right into it. What can you tell us about, you know, yourself and your campaign? What's your elevator pitch, your stump speech? Why vote for you?
Well, I'm a retired Teamster. My running mate's a truck driver. So you got two workers for the White House. And we like to say we're going to put a better class of people in there than we got now. So we both are veteran activists for social and racial justice, labor, the environment. And I started the campaign running on three life or death issues: the climate meltdown, and we're calling for an eco-socialist Green New Deal employing public enterprise and planning to get to zero to negative greenhouse gas emissions and 100% clean energy by 2030. Simply because the carbon budgets that climate science has produced say we got to do that in a rich country like the United States if we're going to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. The second life or death issue is inequality. Inequality is killing us. Working class life expectancies are declining in this country after 50 years of growing economic inequality. So we're calling for an economic bill of rights to end poverty and economic despair. And those rights include a job guarantee, a guaranteed income above poverty, affordable housing, Medicare for all, lifelong public education from pre-K through college and trade school at public institutions, and a secure retirement simply by doubling Social Security benefits. And then the third life or death issue is this new nuclear arms race. The Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists has their doomsday clock, the closest they've ever had it to midnight. The last bilateral treaty between the United States and Russia expires next February 5th. That concerns strategic arms. We're in a world of trouble. So we're calling for peace initiatives. Let's cut the military budget 75%. Let's bring our troops home from these endless wars. Let's pledge no first use of nuclear weapons, disarm our nukes to a minimum credible deterrent, and then go to the other eight nuclear powers and say, we want complete and mutual nuclear disarmament, and go there with the 122 non-nuclear nations that agreed to the text of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons 3 years ago. That should be a top campaign issue, and none of the other presidential campaigns have talked about it. And now we've got another life or death issue, really two: the COVID-19 pandemic. And where we're at, I think it's fair to say the two governing parties in this country are presiding over a failed state. Trump has given up. COVID-19 won, he's a loser. And now he's running around like a modern day typhoid Mary, infecting his own people at super spreader rallies. It's insane. But where is Joe Biden? When you think of Joe Biden, what is he the champion of? He lives within commuter distance of the White House press corps. He could be convening news conferences and beating Trump up over the fact that we do not have a test, contact, trace, and quarantine program like every other organized society in the world that suppressed the virus does. And while he's at it, he could be saying we need universal mail-in ballots so all of us can vote in this pandemic election in November. Instead, we're on pace to 250,000 COVID deaths by the end of the year. So that's another life or death issue. And the last one has come up in the last month is the centuries-old pandemic of racism, which people of color have understood, but now a lot of white people see it because it's on living color on their TVs, and they're mad about it. And they're out in the streets saying, we need to do something about police brutality and the longstanding racism that has impoverished communities of color. So in that regard, we're calling for community control of the police, end the war on drugs, treat drug abuse as a health problem, not a criminal problem that fills up our jails. And then not just defund the police, but have a major federal investment in these racially oppressed communities that have been segregated, discriminated against, and exploited for generations, and lift them up. The best way to fight crime is to fight poverty. So there are a lot of issues there, but they're all very important.
These are the times we live in. It feels like such a ridiculous question to say, you know, why are you running? Summarize it right now when we are in the midst of so many kind of time-defining crises, be it the pandemic, or the financial kind of ruin that we see ourselves in. I want to talk about how the pandemic has impacted your campaign directly. I mean, obviously, third-party campaigns, things that are not Democratic or Republican, already have a disadvantage. How has the pandemic kind of exacerbated that for Team Howie?
Well, in a way, it's kind of helped us. I mean, I was barnstorming around the country, and instead of spending half a day driving halfway across the state or flying halfway across the country, I'm sitting on the computer here talking to more people than I would have otherwise. And the meetings are easier to set up. You know, we just set a time and people tune in. When I go to a city, when I'm physically out there, you got to have local people find a room, get the word out, notify the media, and get the word to the people that might be interested. So since we got locked down in mid-March, we've actually probably talked to more people than we otherwise would have. And that was when not only, you know, we had to speak to the Greens in our primary process, but there are a lot of refugees from the Bernie Sanders campaign who are looking for a candidate that will continue to fight for Medicare for all and a full-strength Green New Deal and college for all and student and medical debt relief and those kinds of things. So it's been an opportunity to reach a lot of people. Now, going forward, looks like we've secured the Green Party nomination. We got a majority of the pledged delegates to win on a first round. How do we get into the media narrative? That's one big obstacle. The other is getting on the ballot, which in the coronavirus situation, the public health recommendations are against going out there and physically getting signatures. So we have been in the process of writing to state governments with a team of lawyers, asking for relief. And some states have put us on the ballot. You've been on the ballot, you know, several election cycles, we'll just put you on. Vermont did that. Illinois said, no, we sued them, we won, we're on the ballot. They appealed, we won on appeal, so we're on the ballot in Illinois. Maryland and New Jersey let us collect electronic signatures. And in the case of Maryland, lowered the number of signatures. So we're going through the states like that, but in some states we haven't got relief. So we're paying petitioners out there in Alaska, Idaho, Kentucky, Arkansas, and they're out there with personal protective equipment and lots of, you know, those hand sanitizer swipes so they can swipe the pen in the petition every time somebody signs. It's difficult, but we are going for all 52 ballots. It's 50 states, the District of Columbia, they all have electoral votes, and then there's the advisory vote that Guam has. So at this point, we're not out of the running to get on any of those ballots, and that's our goal, to get on all of them.
You know, it's obviously it's an incredibly difficult situation for any candidate to find themselves in. I do want to kind of go back to that kind of theme, though, of the uphill battle that third parties have. You know, the Green Party made a huge splash in 2000, obviously, with Ralph Nader. And while he didn't actually necessarily get that large of a percentage of the vote, he was still a very well-known name, decades of activism and in the public eye. But for many people, even on the left, the party's nominees after Nader kind of lost some credibility. And that is part of the conversation, whether it was Cobb, who's kind of outright said he wasn't actually trying to win. McKinney, who was criticized for some views that were kind of outside of the box, not just politically, but maybe in terms of what we'd look at from a, well, let's be honest, there were some accusations of kind of conspiracy theorist stuff. You know, that dialogue came up a bit with Jill Stein. How do you differentiate yourself from these past candidates who A, lost elections, and B, who some people who otherwise might support the policies thought, well, maybe that's just not the best messenger for these policies? What makes Howie Hawkins different than some of the past Green nominees, I guess, is the summary of that question.
Okay. Well, Ralph Nader was a high bar to, you know, a hard act to follow. He, you know, decades and decades of achievements. The legislation he got passed in the 60s and 70s and the regulatory reforms, I think you could probably find that he got more done back then than all the people currently in Congress together in terms of legislation that, you know, really mattered. So he was really, you know, a high standard. What I bring to the table is I've been a grassroots activist through that whole period since the mid-1960s, civil rights, anti-war, unions, environment. And I just bring the fact that I've been in the trenches. You know, I wasn't my idea to run for president. A bunch of Greens said, it's your turn. And I'd been asked before, and I had a time clock to punch at UPS every night. And I didn't have that excuse this time because now I'm retired. So I just think I bring that credibility. And I think the issues we're talking about are majoritarian issues, like Medicare for all. You know, the polls have shown that since Truman. And what Bernie Sanders did was give voice to that after Democrats running for president before him didn't have the guts to do it because they didn't want to take on the health insurance and drug industries. And that moved the debate. Now if people want to keep moving, they need to move with us because we're still advocating for that. Joe Biden is opposed to it. So that's a majoritarian issue. Tax the rich. You know, right now, labor income is taxed at a higher rate than capital income when you count local, state, and federal taxes. That's a shame. You know, we should have a progressive tax structure. So that's a popular issue. Raising the minimum wage, it's $7.25 at the federal level. It's a starvation wage. And I haven't heard Biden talk about it. Trump sure hasn't. We are. So these are issues that I think have broad support. And I hope people will use their vote as an opportunity to speak up and say we want those things.
Well, you know, that I think the minimum wage is a good point to get kind of get in the weeds here. You know, you mentioned got to raise it. I think Trump has, I don't believe, stated any real position on raising the wage, at least not as far as I'm aware. Biden, I believe his website says it should be 15 now. I think he's jumped onto the whole fight for 15 bandwagon. Where do you think it should be?
Well, I think 20 within the next few years. I mean, I was part of the Fight for 15 movement, but that was back in 2012. It's 8 years later. And if you look at what $20 an hour will get you, it will bring a family of three above the poverty line. And if you're going to work full time and support a spouse and a child or a couple children, the wage should be able to do that. So that's one measure. Another is if you adjust the 1968 minimum wage for inflation and the increase in productivity, the amount of value we create every hour, actually the minimum wage would be worth, I think it's between $25 and $27, something like that. So $20, I think, is a reasonable next step. And we would get there in a couple of years, give businesses a chance to adjust their budgets and so forth. And they don't have to worry because their customers will have more money to spend at their business. So that will work out for them. And then we need to index it to both the cost of living inflation and to productivity. One of the problems we've had and why economic inequality has grown and wages have been stagnant for 50 years is that between World War II and 1973, wages grew in concert with increases in productivity. And then they diverged. So productivity has continued to grow, but wages have remained stagnant. So I think indexing the minimum wage to productivity as well as the cost of living will help bring that link back together. And of course, what a minimum wage worker is getting, if you want more skilled and experienced workers, you're gonna have to pay more. So it will bring the whole wage structure closer to the increases in productivity, which is only fair. You know, if we're producing more value, we should get our fair share of it.
I mean, I think that's obviously common sense. The fact that there's probably anyone that's against a minimum wage increase at this point kind of blows my mind. What are some other kind of specific domestic agendas? I mean, you talked about an eco-socialist Green New Deal. What does that look like in practice? Are we talking about like a Works Projects Administration, you know, the WPA out there, but this time they're installing solar panels? Or, you know, what are the specific kind of conversions and changes that you would like to see to society under that type of program?
Well, we have a detailed budget, eco-socialist Green New Deal budget. It's on my website, howiehawkins.us. It's about $42 trillion over 10 years. And 27 and a half of those trillion are for the Green Economy Reconstruction Program, which is not only transforming our power production sector, the power sector that produces electricity, to clean renewables, but all the sectors, transportation, manufacturing, agriculture, and buildings, so that they are all negative, zero to negative greenhouse gas emissions and powered by clean energy, which means we need public ownership of the energy sector, the transportation sector, and a big sector of manufacturing. We need to produce the new clean machinery that can operate with clean power and not produce carbon in the course of their production, like steel. Right now, coke ovens is the predominant way we produce steel. Now, they started to introduce electric arc furnaces. Coke ovens release carbon dioxide. Electric arc furnaces don't. But if we don't have public ownership and planning, the steel industry is going to use those coke ovens till they wear out. And that won't get done in a decade. So we got to substitute old production for new production. Another big one is cement. Portland cement, which is what most of it is, requires calcium carbonate. It's heated up. The calcium hardens the cement, but the carbonate evaporates in the carbon dioxide. And that is 5% of the world's carbon footprint. So that's another productive system we got to transform. And our manufacturing is hollowed out. We hardly have a machine tool industry. And those are the machines that produce other machines for intermediate goods and consumer goods. So we got to rebuild that. And so what we propose to do is do like we did during World War II. In that emergency, the federal government took over or built a quarter of the manufacturing capacity of the country in order to turn industry on a dime into the arsenal of democracy, to arm the allies to defeat the fascist powers. We need to do nothing less to defeat climate change and transform our productive system. So that's why, you know, we call it an eco-socialist Green New Deal. So we're talking about the different sectors. I mentioned manufacturing, buildings. We get rid of gas heating and go to heat pumps that are like refrigerators. You know, push the hot air one way, the cold air the other way. You just flip it around in between the summer and the winter, whether you want to heat or cool the buildings. That can be powered by clean wind and solar energy. Agriculture, we want to move to organic regenerative agriculture, subsidize the transition for farmers, guarantee an income above production costs by having parity pricing and some farm supply management programs, and rebuild the soils, which will bring a lot of carbon out of the atmosphere. I mean, to deal with this climate crisis, we not only have to stop emitting greenhouse gas emissions, we got to draw carbon out of the atmosphere. So soil restoration, afforestation, other habitat restoration, particularly wetlands and mangroves and habitats like that that are carbon intensive. So part of our Green New Deal is a 4 million person strong civilian conservation corps. And that will be focused on, you know, soil habitat restoration and afforestation. And that's the Green Economy Reconstruction Program. Then the Economic Bill of Rights is about $14 trillion a year to provide the job guarantee, the income guarantee, and so forth. So you mentioned the Works Progress Administration. We want to scale that up so that anytime someone can't get a living wage job in the private sector, they can go to the employment office instead of the unemployment office we got today and say, I want my job. And local communities will have social services and public works planned, and people can be plugged in. And it'll be like the Works Progress Administration, except for the large scale projects they did federally. The local projects were planned locally, 90% federally funded, but 10% locally funded. So the local buy-in was to avoid, you know, boondoggles and, you know, wastes of money. So the local community had to make sure they were actually doing something. And we just need to scale that up so there's a job guarantee. And so I could keep going, but you know, people go to my website, they can, you know, look at the whole thing. I'll just say one more. AOC and Bernie Sanders came out with a Green New Deal public housing program, which is in the right direction, but their scale is about, I think it's a 5% of what we're talking about. We want to build 25 million units of public housing over the next 10 years. It's a $2.5 trillion investment. And we want the public housing to be mixed income, not just segregated housing for poor people of color, which is what we built until we stopped building it in the 70s. But we reserve 40% for low-income people, which would be 10 million units. There are 7.8 million households that are low-income and don't have access to affordable housing. So we cover them, but we create mixed-income communities to desegregate by race and class. So they'd be powered by clean energy. It'd be a jobs program. It'd be a desegregation program. We'd link it to planning for public and mass transit to create walkable communities. So it'd be a walkable communities program as well as an affordable housing program. I mean, you can build quite a coalition around that program. And that's one of the things we want to do. So I could go on and on, but a lot of the details are there in the budget on our website.
I want to ask a little bit about, your relationship with the Green Party, because you're often billed as a co-founder of the Green Party. You were back there in the 80s, at the onset of it. What can you tell us the kind of that narrative? How did that come to be? How did the Green Party in the United States come to be? And what was your role in it?
Well, I have been committed to an independent working class party on the left since the 1960s, because I saw the Democrats and the Republicans in 1964 basically tell people, black people, later for civil rights. You know, they let the Dixiecrats, not the Freedom Democrats, sit at the Democratic Convention. And in my state of California, Reagan was leading a referendum fight to repeal the fair housing law that had just passed. So I was asking, where's my party? And so I supported Peace and Freedom Party in 1968, which became part of the People's Party in 72 and 76. And then we had the Citizens Party with Barry Commoner in 1980, our foremost environmental scientist. And, you know, meanwhile, I was involved in social movements, particularly the anti-nuclear movement, and was involved in organizing the Clamshell Alliance. We had a big occupation of the Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant site in 1977. 1,414 of us were arrested and put in National Guard armories for 10 days. It was all over the media. It made the anti-nuclear movement go national. So I was in, well, the people organizing this first meeting of a Green Party invited the Clamshell Alliance to send a couple people. So they sent, I was one of the people they sent. And when I got there, I said, I've been through these four campaigns and we can't build a party out of a presidential campaign. We got to go out, organize local groups, get involved in local politics and build it from the bottom up, which I still believe. And really since then, for the last 35 years, that's been my primary focus. I mean, I was there at the beginning, I've been active the whole time, but I wasn't in the national leadership. I was here in Syracuse, New York, and New York State, you know, building a serious party here. And, then people around the country took note and asked me to run for president. Now, how that relates to building from below, which I still think we need to do, is in 40 of the 51 electoral college jurisdictions, the vote that the presidential candidate gets determines whether the party will have a ballot line for the next election cycle. In most states, it's 1, 2, or 3%. And when you have that ballot line, it's much easier for local candidates to run. You know, like, let's just use Congress because I got those numbers in my head. In New York State, where I'm at, if you want to run for Congress in my congressional district as a Green, you need about 100 signatures of Greens. If you want to run as an independent because you don't have the ballot line, you need 3,500. Which really means 7,000, and you only have 6 weeks to collect them. And it's worse in other states. In Illinois, it's over 15,000. In Georgia, it's over 20,000. Now, compare that to other countries. I mean, our ballot access requirements are ridiculous. They're off the charts. You want to run for the equivalent of Congress in New Zealand, it's 2 signatures. You want to run for the House of Commons as an independent in the United Kingdom, it's 10 signatures. In Australia, it's 50. In Canada, it's 50 to 100. They let the rural ridings 50 because they're so dispersed, you know, up there in the Arctic. It's a fraction of what we have to get. So getting these ballot lines is building a scaffolding on which we can elect people from the local office. Now, the Greens in this country have 129 elected officials. It's one of the best kept secrets in politics. And that's probably more than any party on the left. You have to go back to the heyday of the Socialist Party. On the other hand, it's a drop in the bucket. There's about 500,000 elected offices in this country. So I'm saying we should be electing thousands as we go into the 2020s. Build that base from the local level to the state legislatures to Congress. And when we got a caucus in Congress, we run a ticket for president, they won't be able to ignore us.
You know, that, and it does seem like the conversation around third parties is slightly starting to change. You know, we had Justin Amash obviously flirt with the idea of running as a libertarian. He's still sitting in Congress. I think it's kind of nebulous on whether he's now an independent or if he's a libertarian serving in Congress. And, you know, it's arguably probably just a matter of semantics. But I think for the parties, that's not a matter of semantics. If a big name like that on the left were to suddenly announce that they were a Green, how would that change the nature of your candidacy or of future campaigns? And how much of a goal has that been for the party of trying to convert people that are already sitting on the left flank of the Democratic Party in office and trying to get them to come over and be a Green?
Well, I told on one of these podcasts, I was asked, you know, what would you say to Bernie Sanders? And I said, well, if you're ready to break with the Democrats and come to the Green Party, we should talk. I'm not in a position to hand them the nomination, stay out of the way, because that's up to the delegates. And they've been voting. So, but, you know, when I thought about it, he'd be a great surrogate for our campaign because he, you know, he can command a national stage. It would help a lot. But, of course, he's taking a different direction. But in general, I mean, we had Ralph Nader in 2000. We're not going to build this with celebrities. We got to build it at the grassroots. We need to have local chapters in the communities of people that vote in low numbers, working class people, people of color, and young people. And they need to know us personally because we've been there with them. We've talked to them. We've listened. You know, activists tend to go out and preach, you know, we got an issue. Here's the leaflet. Join us at this march or this public hearing or whatever it is. And a lot of these people that are alienated from the political process say, who the hell are you? Why should I listen to what you're saying? We have politicians always telling us what we should vote for. We don't even know you, and we don't think you know us and our problems and our issues and what we're going through. So we got to go out and organize the kind of things a union or community organizer knows. They don't go out and preach, they go out and listen, and they build relationships and friendships and trust over time. And then when we're in those communities and we get attacked by the corporate media or the Democrats for being spoilers or whatever they're going to say, people say, no, we know these people. We know who they are. We know them by name, and they're with us. We can count on them. That's how we're going to build this party into a major party. There's no shortcut with celebrities. There's no shortcut around really organizing at the grassroots. And, you know, I think that's a problem not just with the Green Party, but the whole progressive social movement scene. I mean, I'm out of the new left of the 60s, and I think we got over-impressed with what we did in the civil rights and anti-war movements, because we went out in the streets and we got some results. And so we decided electoral politics is irrelevant. We don't really need organizations. We just need to mobilize. And I think in transcending the old left, which was slow on feminism and environmentalism and some other issues, we threw the baby out with the bathwater and forgot how to build organizations at the grassroots. So we're connected to the people. Instead, you can't reach the people through Facebook, I don't care how clever you are, or a TV ad. That's not really gonna do it. And particularly what we're talking about on the left, which is, you know, a real grassroots democracy in this society where the people participate in the decisions that affect their lives. Well, we gotta create something through which they can participate. So I think, you know, the Greens have a long way to go, but so does the whole social movement left in that regard.
It's an interesting thing that you had touched on there, which was your own experience in the new left of the 60s. How do you see, having witnessed kind of that movement in that time frame, how do you kind of compare that in your head to this, I don't know, new left that we see rising right now? Where are the discrepancies and differences, and where are the similarities between the two?
Well, I think the similarities is a large segment of those people have faith that they can get what they want through the Democratic Party. You know, the SDS slogan in 64 was part of the way with LBJ. And they weren't enamored of him, but he was certainly better than Goldwater. And you could make that argument, but then LBJ escalated rapidly in Vietnam. And the reaction to that was a good one. the anti-war slogan was out now. And when it came to 1968, we demanded that upon the so-called anti-war candidates, McCarthy and Kennedy, who were just saying negotiations. And we're saying there's nothing to negotiate. We should just get out. And then when it was Nixon and Humphrey, we didn't say Humphrey's the lesser evil. We demanded out now on both of them. Nixon got elected, but in the fall of 69, we didn't realize this for a few years until the memoirs started coming out. But the secret plan to end the war in Vietnam that Nixon had talked about was to use tactical nuclear weapons in North Vietnam. And in the fall of 69, we had a massive, they called it the Vietnam moratorium on a weekday. It was practically a general strike. And exactly one month later on a Saturday, we had the biggest anti-war demonstrations yet. And that convinced Nixon and Kissinger they couldn't execute their secret plan. Nixon wouldn't be able to win the re-election. In fact, some of them thought it would provoke a revolution. I don't think I was in the movement. I don't think we were ready for that, but they were scared. And so that shows what happens when you're independent. And then after that, there was a period where, you know, most of the New Left people said we just need to, you know, be out there demonstrating. But the problem with that is if there's not an electoral alternative, the Democrats can just give you lip service and let that roll off their backs because there's no threat to their voting base. And I think that's the situation today. You know, most of the new socialist movement is, you know, backing socialist types. Most of them are really New Dealers, liberals. They're not talking about social ownership and democratic administration of the major means of production, which is, you know, the traditional socialist program. In any case, that's where a lot of energy is going. And I think until the left has its own party, its own voice, its own identity, it's going to keep getting lost in the sauce of the Democratic Party. I mean, what do you do now? Sanders is out. You vote for Biden. Nobody knows you're a socialist or a progressive. You voted for the guy who's against Medicare for All, who really doesn't want a Green New Deal. He wants to sequester carbon emissions, you know, still wants to frack the hell out of the country, all of the above energy policy he had during the Obama administration. So nobody knows, you know, that you're a progressive. You vote for the Greens, your voice is heard. That vote counts. So I think, you know, that's the argument we have now, like we had back in the 60s. I mean, there was an effort on the left to form an independent party. That was Peace and Freedom and the People's Party. But when McGovern got the nomination, a lot of the new left got with McGovern. And then they got with Jesse Jackson. And now in their old age, a lot of them are with Bernie Sanders. But what did they got to show for it? You know, Bernie showed how to do it. He ran as an independent, got elected mayor of Burlington, Vermont. And then the Congress member from Vermont. And then the senator from Vermont. He won. He ran as a Democrat in the Democratic primary and the establishment cut him off. I think that's the lesson that today's new left should learn. We can win independently. We don't have to go in the Democratic Party to win.
You know, the one thing I tend to hear, and I think this kind of pushes back, but you know, you hear from Greens regularly, well, there's no difference between the Republicans and Democrats, which has always stricken me as kind of intellectually dishonest. And at the same time, I'm curious what you think of that specifically.
It's obviously not true. I mean, there are differences. You know, the Democrats are pro-choice Republicans. The Republicans are anti-abortion Republicans. And you can find some other little differences. You know, on the social issues, very different tone, and certainly some difference in substance, you know, in terms of racial justice and women's rights and gay rights, and environmental protection. I mean, the Democrats are for more regulation and standards. But when it comes to the basic economic policies, you know, they're both what they call now neoliberalism, which means market competition for the working class and state subsidies for the corporate class, and for a very aggressive foreign policy. And that's, you know, though there the differences are not so much. I mean, when Trump had Juan Guaido, the U.S. appointed new president of Venezuela, like we have a right to do that, in the gallery, and Trump gave him props. I've looked at the videos. I can't see one Democrat that did not stand up and give him a standing ovation like the Republicans. You know, it's pretty much with a very few number of dissenters, bipartisan support for regime change in Venezuela. You know, and I wouldn't give a, you know, high marks to Venezuela and some of its democratic norms and practices, but this country really can't talk about it. I mean, we're a police state. We have the largest prison system in the history of the world. We have 4% of the world's population and 25% of its prisoners. And we got a president, fortunately the general slapped him back, who wanted to send out the military to suppress these recent demonstrations. So before we can lecture anybody about human rights and democracy, we need to clean up our own act.
And, you know, the Venezuela thing is something that example specifically, and I think your assessment of it there was actually great. One thing that I feel like would frustrate me is, you know, that I would see on the left is people who wanted to rush to defend Maduro, like he was a good or competent leader. And I think that really is kind of obviously false. But the flip side of that does not need to be, you know, pushing in imperialistic regime change either, or backing Guaido, who's essentially just this right-wing guy from their legislature who just said, well, I'm in charge now. And it struck me as incredibly, like, a level of just cognitive dissonance that people couldn't see that you can kind of openly criticize both of these as not the best option for a government, or to not see the inherent danger of someone like Guaido just stepping in. I mean, that is a militaristic coup if there's ever been one.
Yeah, and there's some Latin American countries and Norway and others that have had negotiations between Maduro and some of the opposition that was willing to negotiate. But the U.S. discouraged Guaido's people from participating.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are standing in the way of, you know, them dealing with their problems. And they do have problems, no doubt. Instead, we're imposing sanctions and making them worse in the midst of a world pandemic. I mean, that's just cruelty. And I mean, I think from 60 years of blockading Cuba, we should know that that doesn't open up a society to a multi-party democracy. It makes them batten down the hatches and defend themselves. In the case of Cuba, I mean, we tried to assassinate Fidel Castro many times, and we invaded them and threatened to invade them many times. And we've had this, you know, very hard economic blockade on them. So it's not surprising that they're repressive in order to organize their defense. That hasn't worked. You know, I think, you know, maybe the carrot instead of the stick is a better approach.
There is this, in the second half of the 20th century and into the 21st century, there is this kind of bizarre approach in the West and specifically in the US when it comes to concepts of diplomacy. I mean, one, there's just imperialistic goals, and that I mean, is an undercurrent, right? But there is this, even when you do get a candidate or when you do get political leaders who are open to the idea of diplomacy, there's this rush to kind of beat them up. And it's like it's the specter of Neville Chamberlain almost. I mean, I think of Vice President Wallace, and that was one of the criticisms levied against him all the time under FDR was, you know, well, he'll just appease authoritarian governments and let them do whatever they want, not understanding that there is some type of middle ground here between letting people get slaughtered or starved to death or whatever the case may be and bombing those same people. Like there's the goal should be a pursued course that doesn't kill people, you know, one way or the other. And how is one of those outcomes, if you're a guy working, you know, going about his day in Venezuela or the Middle East or wherever, I don't think it really matters to you too much on who's killing you if you're still, you and your family are winding up dead at the end of the day. And that, I think, gets to something that gets overlooked, but something that you've been talking about. You know, a lot of times third-party candidates, especially Green Party candidates, I feel like they get asked a lot of questions about domestic policy, about environmental issues, about issues related to economics. You do seem to talk quite a bit about foreign policy. How would a Howie Hawkins administration deal with a situation like Venezuela or any other government that's kind of in flux? How would you be engaging with them? What types of resolutions would you be looking to see?
Well, in the case of Venezuela, I would lift the sanctions, offer aid, normal business relations. Their oil sector's in, you know, deep trouble. We have companies that know what they're doing, and encourage a reasonable, contract if that's what they want to do. They do have a state-owned company, but it's lost a lot of its competencies, and they often was subcontracting to Western oil companies anyway. So that's an area where we could help them. And why not? Of course, we want to move beyond oil and gas, and their big oil fields are, tar sands, which are the worst. So, while we help them, produce oil during the transition to renewables, let's help them leap over the fossil fuel age into the solar age. And, there were initiatives under Hugo Chavez that were along those lines, not completely. I mean, at one point he was talking about getting nuclear power plants, which I think was crazy. But I'm thinking more of the communal state he talked about based on a grassroots democracy, which the Zapatistas and the Kurds in Syria have tried to implement to various degrees. And that's something that is, I think, a good model for us. And actually, we have experience. Our town meetings in New England is direct democracy at the local level and is the cradle of our democracy. So there could be productive exchanges along those lines. But I think, trying to have a productive relationship instead of, now it looks like, this regime change war is another war for oil. Let's take over Venezuela and bring in, Chevron and Exxon and BP and the rest of them. And, they'll run Venezuela like another petrol state. And that's the last thing we need when we're in a climate emergency. So I think we're better off having economic and cultural exchanges. That was Thomas Paine's foreign policy. He was definitely a revolutionary. He was in our revolution. He was in the French Revolution. He got in trouble in Britain. But he really said the best way to advance these democratic ideals is through commerce and cultural exchange. And I still think that's true. So the other thing we can do is clean up our own act in terms of human rights and democracy. And then when we speak out, when we see violations, we have credibility. Right now, I think we just went over to ballot access requirements. The Helsinki Accords were set up back in the 70s, basically to criticize the East Bloc, the Soviet Bloc, for violating democratic norms. Now that body criticizes the United States more than anybody else. We have voter suppression. We have party suppression. In my state in New York, they just tripled the ballot access requirements, doubled the frequency you have to meet them to stay on a ballot. And if you lose a ballot, tripled the signature requirements. That's the Democratic Party. When we sued Illinois to get on the ballot and they said no, that was a Democratic state party. Party suppression is part of voter suppression. 61% of Jill Stein's voters in 2016 were asked in exit polls, well, if she wasn't on the ballot, who would you vote for? 61% said, I wouldn't have been here to vote. We bring new voters to the polls. So that's getting off from foreign policy toward Venezuela. But I think, the point is, we can talk about democracy when we practice it ourselves, and the cultural and economic exchanges open up the world to, see what democracy can do.
And I know we're pushing the time here a bit, but before we wrap it up, I do want to ask you, would you like to see federal protections on some of these kind of democratic reforms you're talking about, things that would protect third parties, and what types of federal regulation would you like to see in regards to the election system, if any?
Well, one thing I remember Ralph Nader mentioning in his stump speeches in 2000 was that the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, had a model piece of legislation around since 1940, setting a reasonable federal standard for ballot access for federal candidates. And it was a fraction of the signatures are now required. We could have a federal law that required federal candidates in the states to have fair ballot access. There's legislation, I think his name's Byron, Virginia is the lead sponsor, to have ranked choice voting for multi-party districts to Congress. So the districts would be 3 or 5 or 10 members. So like in a 5-member district, you could have a member of a party when you reach the 20% threshold representing you in Congress. So it'd be proportional. And that's how we get a multi-party democracy. And then of course, and you know, the most common question I get from the mainstream media is, aren't you afraid of being a spoiler for Joe Biden? And I say, no, I'm afraid of Joe Biden for spoiling this whole damn election, because we have been giving the Democrats the proven nonpartisan solution to spoiled elections and presidential elections. And that is to replace the Electoral College with a ranked choice national popular vote for president. You know, why won't Joe Biden embrace that? Why won't the Democratic Party embrace that? They have lost to the last two Republicans when they were first elected because of the Electoral College. They won the popular vote. Gore won the popular vote. The Electoral College put Bush in, along with the Supreme Court stopping the recount in Florida. And then Trump lost by 3 million votes, the popular vote, and the Electoral College put him in there. You would think the Democrats would say, hey, we got a problem here. And instead of focusing on that, they focus on trying to keep the Green Party off the ballot. You know, my advice to them is get your own base out. Worry about your own problems. And, you know, the fact is, if they thought about it, we bring more voters to the polls, but we don't have candidates for down ballot races and all the races. And our voters are more likely to vote for a Democrat than a Republican in those down ballot races. In fact, in 2000, the votes that Nader brought to, say, Michigan, where Debbie Stabenow was first elected U.S. Senator, his votes were far more than the margin of difference for her narrow win. And the same thing for that woman in Senator from Washington State, whose name is escaping me. So, you know, the Democrats, you know, we're not their biggest problem by any means.
I think that's a fair assessment, a beyond fair assessment. Well, Howie, before I let you go, I do like to end all these programs by asking the same question, which is a break from the rest of the dialogue we've had here. That is, you know, throughout your entire career as an activist, a politician, as a Teamster, you know, what is the thing that you most hope to convey to other people? What is it that you're, what is kind of your central message that you want to get out there?
Well, to the average person that gets involved in trying to make progressive social change, realize it's a marathon, not a sprint. That you may be a minority, even a vilified minority for a long time. But if you look at history, you'll see that these things go in big steps. And suddenly public opinion flips. So while you're putting your message out there, you're convincing people that won't even admit to you that you've convinced them. I mean, I saw that in the anti-Vietnam War movement. I saw it in the anti-nuclear movement. Anti-apartheid movement. I mean, nobody was really against what we were saying. They're just saying you can't get it done because the establishment wants to make money off apartheid in South Africa. And then in 1 year, we went from nowhere to having Congress override the veto of Reagan on sanctions against South Africa, right down to getting a fracking ban in New York, which, you know, I was not optimistic about. We were campaigning for it for 6 years before we got it, but, you know, you had capitalists from all over the world, you know, Saudi Arabia, Russia, China, wanting to get in on what they call the shale play here in New York and Pennsylvania and so forth. And, you know, we got 5% of the vote on top of a social movement in 2014. And Cuomo couldn't take us for granted with that 5%. So he had to come our way. We got a ban on fracking. So look at history, have faith, and be patient. And just be satisfied that, you know, if you're convinced you're right, then that's all you need, who you need to convince to be right with yourself. And just keep plugging away and have patience and persistence. And in the end, it pays off.
Well, Howie, thank you so much for coming on the program. That is Howie Hawkins, candidate for U.S. president. And as always, I'm Alex Kack. This is Sorry for Rambling. We'll see you next time.